Genesis 12:1 through 12:4, the 13th talk in a series on Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 9, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
At chapter 12, the text takes a turn. Up to chapter 12, the text has been dealing with all of mankind. It hasn't been focusing in on any particular group, but it has talked about mankind in general and taken some incidents out of the history of mankind as examples of what's happening in mankind. But now the text is going to shift and we're going to focus on one family. For the rest of Genesis, we will just be following one family, Abram and his descendants. Also, earlier in the book, God was dealing more directly with mankind. Up until the flood. God seems to be dealing directly with mankind, entering into judgment of mankind in a very personal way. Then after the flood, God seems to be stepping back into the background and letting things kind of unfold as they will unfold and being less overt in the way that he involves himself in history. But now we're going to see him revealing himself to one man in his family and dealing with them very personally and very directly. So instead of dealing directly with all of mankind, he focuses in and on one man and his family. So it's a really important turn that's happening in this text, and we need to pay attention to that switch. And the impetus behind this change, I think, is that the first part of Genesis is explaining to us what is the problem that faces mankind. That's what the first 11 chapters are trying to portray. What's the problem in mankind? Then when we start in chapter 12, it's going to be God's solution to that problem. Now, what is the problem? I want to go back and, in just a few minutes, try to describe what has happened up to now in Genesis and what is the nature of the problem that's being depicted here. If you'll recall, in the garden, Adam and Eve had been told not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which had been placed in the garden. But they ate of it. And the question that they were facing is, who is better qualified to decide how I ought to live my life? Is it God, the one who created me, the one who knows me intimately, and who has done things even here in the garden that demonstrate his love and concern for me? Or is it me? I may be finite, but at least I know that I am interested in myself. If there's anyone who's interested in my interests, it's me. That was the choice that they were faced with, and the choice that they made was, I am going to go with me. I know that I am interested in myself. I'm not so sure about God. So at that point, man decided that he was going to be his own boss. Man was going to be autonomous from God. He was going to stand in judgment over what God had told him to do. He was going to decide for himself what he would do and what he would not do. That was rebelliousness. That is the nature of sin. God's response to that was a very loving response if one understands what God is doing. God's response to that was to plunge man into a state of futility. What God said was, everything that you do, it will fail. That you have set out to be your own boss. You were not made to be a god. You don't have the wisdom, the understanding that it takes to know what is even good for yourself. For you to be a rebel is to live a life that you were not intended to live. And in response to that, God has said, when you go out and try to gain fulfillment, try to gain satisfaction, try to meet your own needs that I have built into you, I am going to guarantee that you fail. As a result, man's experience of life is going to be this constant frustration and futility. It's like chasing mirages. It looks like there's water out there, but as you get closer, it all disappears. It's not there anymore. When man goes out looking for fulfillment and satisfaction, a sense of things are right, things are going right, things are working, it's always going to dissolve in his hands. It's not going to happen. There is never going to be that sense that things are right and things are working ultimately the way they're supposed to be. And in the absence of man's, the purpose for God's strategy is to point out what a poor God we are. We just can't do it. And he won't let us do it. But we will keep trying. And as we fail, our attempts will become more and more desperate, running faster and farther to other mirages, looking for fulfillment. As a result, it becomes a kind of desperate madness that comes over mankind, going always faster and farther in different directions looking for fulfillment. It's a madness. It's a blindness as to what indeed will really satisfy and fulfill us. And it's also a hopelessness, because the more we try, the more things fail. Cain, then, is kind of the epitome of this madness. Cain and his brother Abel both gave offerings to God. They gave offerings to God because they wanted to be seen, they wanted to achieve the approval of God. And Cain couldn't do it. His offerings were not acceptable to God. And Cain, in response, because his offerings aren't working, what does he do? He kills his brother. Because he can't receive approval from God, he kills his brother. It makes no sense. He's killing someone, he's killing his own relative, who is absolutely innocent of doing anything wrong in general, and certainly no wrong towards Cain. And yet, in Cain's mind, if I just eliminate my brother, I've solved the problem? That's crazy. So there's a madness that comes over mankind as a result of his rebellion. And in his particular case, that madness took the form of jealousy. Well, Cain wasn't the only one that was controlled by this madness. This rebelliousness reigned throughout all of mankind. And that point is made really clear in Genesis 6:5, just before the flood. The reason that God chooses to bring that flood as a judgment on mankind is because every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That man is rebellious to the core. unrepentantly rebellious. And so God brings judgment in the form of the flood. Only Noah was righteous. So God chooses Noah out, takes him out, spares him the judgment, both him and his family. But the rest of the mankind is destroyed by the flood. But right after the flood, the ground is scarcely dried out, and one of Noah's sons, Ham, commits an act of horrendous disrespect in the very least. So we see that the judgment that God brought on mankind, it doesn't tame and harness the rebelliousness that is inside of him. Then, after the flood, man spreads out, and what we see in mankind is a kind of arrogance and an attempt for him to take things into his own hands by building kingdoms or building empires. So man has become hardened and more entrenched in the rebellion that he has demonstrated in the earlier part of Genesis. So there's the problem. Man is an incorrigible rebel who refuses to look into the nature of the evil that is within him. He is blind to it, and he's kind of driven by a madness. God's solution, then, is a rather striking solution. What he decides to do is pick some man, and what he's going to do is he's going to build into this man a sense of faith in both God and God's promises. Now, there's no reason given why Abram was the one who was selected to be the example of the strategy that God is embarking upon. There was the promise to Shem that indicates that God would deal directly and in a particular, in a special way with the descendants of Shem. Abram fits that qualification. But other than that, there's no reason given in the text why it would be Abram and not some other Semite. He was basically an everyman. There's no indication that he was a worshiper of Yahweh prior to when God comes to him. We know from Joshua that Abram's forefathers were polytheists. They were not faithful to Yahweh. And I think it highly likely that Abram starts out a polytheist as well. But we will see as Genesis describes the life of Abram, that Abram is going to become converted to Yahwism, that he comes to see God as the God that he is. He will grow in trust. As I pointed out last time, Abram is a man who grew up in an urban culture, one of the most advanced cultures in the world at the time. But that culture had fallen into chaos. Abram was apparently part of this trend of fleeing from that chaos, and he goes up to the upper part of the Mesopotamian Valley, and then, as we will see, God moves him on from there. That upper part of the Mesopotamian Valley would have been like going to the frontier, and then he moves on. God leads him to Canaan, which is wilder yet. It is highly likely that Abram had to, leaving an urban environment, had to learn how to be a semi-nomadic person, raising his own crops and taking care of himself. So Abram is in no way an obvious choice to be picked out to be an example of this way that God is going to work within mankind. But nevertheless, he was the one chosen. When I read about Abram It reminds me of an incident when I was a freshman in college. I was studying in Philadelphia, and I went to McDonald's to have a meal one time, and I bought my food and I sat down with my tray, and this little black kid crawled up into my lap and turned around and looked at me and said, "I'm going to help you eat your lunch." And my first thought was, who invited you? Well, God is kind of crawling up into Abram's lap and he's saying, "I'm going to bless you." And Abram says, "Well, where did I ask for this?" I mean, for whatever reasons, it was Abram that God selected out to deal with in a very special way. And it's not clear that this made Abram's life easier. It didn't necessarily make Abram's life a piece of cake. But we'll see that God did indeed bless him in a way that was truly remarkable. Okay, let's read Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. This is what God says to Abram. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" This must have been remarkable to Abram, to have God come to him and make this statement, and Abram's thoughts must have been, what does this mean? First of all, he is told, leave everything that you have known. Leave your homeland, and apparently that's referring to Haran, the area in the upper Mesopotamian area, to which Abram and his father Terah had gone from Ur. So if you remember, if you still have your map from last week, or if you can remember, apparently Abram was born and raised in Ur, in the lower part of the Mesopotamian Valley. But he seems to have been a part of the Amorites, which is a Semitic group, which had moved down from the upper part of Mesopotamia down into the lower part of Mesopotamia probably a couple hundred years before Abram is called out of there. So there's a sense in which Abram is going back to his homeland. It's like someone immigrating to the United States and then after a period of time going back to the homeland. Well, that's what Abram is apparently doing. So Haran is apparently what's being referred to as the homeland. Terah, when he left Ur, apparently intended to go to Canaan, which would have been farther. But he got halfway. He got to the ancestral lands of the Amorites and apparently settled in there and stayed. And that's where Terah ends up dying. But it's that land, at Haran, where apparently things were fairly comfortable. That's Terah decided to stay there. But God calls Abram to move on from there. So leave your homeland. Leave your relatives. And leave your father's house. So it becomes more and more specific and more heart-wrenching. Abram is being called to leave everything that's familiar and secure. I mean, if there's anything that gives us security in life, it's that which is closest to us, and in most cases, that's family. And yet God is calling Abram to leave everything that provides that kind of security and to go elsewhere. And go where? God is not specific. He says, to the land which I will show you. Go where I direct you. So he's not giving him, Abram, a clear picture of what it is that's in store. Leave what's familiar and go to the unknown. That's what Abram is being told to do. Leave everything that provides you security and go where who knows what will happen. So it's calling Abram to a new start, and it's calling him to leave everything behind that has provided him security. So he is going to be more than ever at the mercy of whatever's out there. He's going to be particularly vulnerable. But God goes on to make a series of promises to Abram. First of all, he says, I will make you a great nation. In the ancient world, it was considered to be of paramount importance to have heirs, to have something that you leave behind that's a part of you. That's what makes life worth living, is this sense that there is, I have left a lasting imprint in this world. There's something that will live on after me that I have produced. In modern times, we're inclined to think in other terms. It's not heirs so much that we look towards as it is fame or fortune, or there are any number of things that we can look to as giving us a sense that our life counted. My life had some kind of impact. And that's one of the great frustrations that we deal with in life, is knowing that within just a few years of dying, there will be very little left behind that even remembers me or remembers the impact of my life. I mean, within one generation, your memory will be largely gone. So God is making a very significant promise here. I am going to make you a great nation. In other words, you are going to have an impact. Abram at the time was 75 years old and was childless. It doesn't look very promising. It doesn't look like this is likely to happen. And yet this is what God has promised. Secondly, he promises that he will bless Abram. Now, generally, if you look at the Old Testament, when God blesses someone, that becomes manifest in increased wealth. As we look through the lives of the patriarchs, that's generally what we see happening. But I don't think that that's what it's talking about. Wealth is not primarily what's in view here. That they will be blessed means their life will have a positive impact. Their life will have a richness and a fullness and a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction. Wealth usually comes along with this, but I think it's simply an external sign of something more profound and more significant. God is saying, I will make you, Abram, successful. It just so happens that God includes in that wealth, but that's not primarily what he has in mind. The third promise that he makes to him, he says, I will make your name great. He is going to give Abram a glory, a fame, a significance that he would not otherwise have. Abram's life is going to count. It's going to have an impact. The fourth thing that he promises is he says, I will make you a blessing. So not only is he going to bless Abram, but he's going to make Abram a blessing, presumably to others. That as a result of Abram's life, good will come to others, that there will be healing and there will be a fulfillment and satisfaction that is achievable by others. But Abram's going to be kind of a dividing line. He says, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. Those who bless Abram, that is, those who praise him and identify with Abram, God, in turn, is going to bless them. But those who do ill to Abram, those who look down upon Abram, God will curse them. So Abram is going to become the dividing line among mankind. And man will fall into one category or the other, depending upon how they respond to Abram. Do they approve of Abram and his values and the path that he has chosen in life? Or do they look down on that? That's going to be the critical choice. And then lastly, and in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That through Abraham, blessing will come upon people all over the earth, in families all over the earth. It's interesting, it's not saying that everyone will be blessed, but rather this blessing will affect every family. So I think what it's indicating is that there will be individuals all over the earth who will be blessed through Abraham and his significance. What's interesting about this initial communication with Abram is that on the one hand, it's asking Abram to do something that's very scary. Go out and leave everything that is familiar to you and gives you security. But on the other hand, it's not giving him any immediate response. It's not giving him any immediate good. I will make you a great nation. Clearly, that's going to take time. He won't instantly become a great nation. I will bless you. It's going to take time to see that. I will make your name great. That too is going to develop over time, etc., etc. All of these are more or less promises for the future. So all Abram has at this point is the hope that these will come to pass. Now, it is interesting to note that in each of these blessings, God is, in a sense, providing the very things that man in his rebelliousness was trying to achieve on his own. He says that he will make Abram a great nation. That's exactly what Nimrod was setting out to do on his own. Nimrod was trying to create an empire, build an empire. Amass power. Why does he want to amass power? So that he can control his environment, so that he can have the power to bring the things to pass that he wants to bring to pass. That's what man as a god wants to do. He wants to find a way to bring his will to pass. And one of the ways of doing that is to build empire. Babel was a similar kind of attempt. Bring man together, bring all of the power and capability that is there, bring that all, harness that for your purposes to overcome the pain and the sorrow that fills life. A blessing. God says he's going to bless Abram. That's what Cain wanted. Cain was offering the sacrifices. He wanted the approval of God. But he wasn't getting it. So what's he do? He kills his brother. It's a nonsense solution, but what he wanted was God's blessing. And here, God is just giving it as a gift to Abram. To make his name great. If you will recall, that was one of the goals when they built the Tower of Babel. Chapter 11, verse 4. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." So one of the things that they were trying to achieve was to make a name for themselves, to gain glory and fame. Here, God is turning to Abram and saying, "I'm going to do that for you." And security. Much of what was driving sinful man before this time was the search for security. Cain, after he was punished for having put Abel to death, he responds to God in arrogance and a kind of rebelliousness. And he says, "This isn't fair. Someone will find me and kill me." And God says, "Don't worry. If anybody messes with you, I'll really mess with them." But that's no security to Cain, because Cain's problem from the very beginning is he doesn't trust God. He would have to trust God for that promise to be of any value. So what does Cain do? He goes and builds a city. He's going to take care of his own security. He can't trust God to do it, so he will do it. Here, God is coming to Abram and saying, "If anybody messes with you, they will be cursed." God is providing security for Abram above and beyond anything that Cain could achieve, and above and beyond anything that the people of Babel were able to achieve. So what God is doing here is, in a sense, he's reversing the curse. That in response to man's rebelliousness, what God had said is, "Your life is going to be a life of futility. I am going to make sure that you always fail in attaining satisfaction and fulfillment." Now what God is going to do is he is going, and that strategy, there's a sense in which, I need to be careful here, there's a sense in which that strategy is unsuccessful, because man just turns to more and more desperate attempts to find his own fulfillment. But here with Abram, what God is going to do is he's going to make himself known to Abram. He's just going to go to work in Abram's life and transform him. He's going to open his eyes to the goodness of God. In other words, part of what he's going to do is open Abram's eyes so that he can see that the pain and futility in life is actually an act of love on God's part. It has a redemptive purpose. And he's going to develop in Abram, by a series of events, God is going to develop in Abram a trust and a faith in God that is going to be truly remarkable before we finish the account of Abram. Abram is going to learn to trust God implicitly and his promises. And one day, those promises will all be fulfilled. It is worthy of note that there is a sense in which none of the promises that God made to Abram were fully fulfilled in his lifetime. Abram was living on the expectation of the ultimate fulfillment of those, and he grew to the place where he could count on that happening because of the trust that he developed in God as a result of God working in his life. In doing this, God is able to take away that futility. Abram is going to experience a degree of fulfillment and satisfaction that he never would have had otherwise. Abram is going to be truly blessed in that sense. So God here is reversing the curse that he has placed on mankind. And he is finding a way in which he can bring fulfillment to man despite man's rebellious heart. Okay, I didn't leave any time for questions last time, so I am going to stop here and entertain any questions on last time or stuff from this week.
You described early on in your teaching the madness of pursuing our own benefit, our own interests and so forth, and I've been thinking about that. I mean, it's true that we pursue our own benefit, and sometimes that's met with futility. And we're all, to a certain degree or another, blessed by God, but it's difficult to separate the blessing of God from our own effort as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that joke where the guy's praying that God would help him win the lottery, and he keeps praying and praying and praying, and God says, well, you know, at least buy a ticket. You know, that there's a synthesis somehow of our own effort. And I'm wondering, well, if we're not pursuing our own interests and welfare, I mean, you could say, well, we're supposed to pursue the interests and welfare of others, but you would run out of resources pretty quickly if you weren't. You know what I'm saying? I was just hoping you could kind of address the more practical implications of that.
Let me answer, and then you can tell me whether I answered your question. Part of this blindness or madness is not understanding what is in our best interests. That in our rebelliousness, we are really confused about what is good for us. Very deeply confused about that. We look for fulfillment in places that it's hopeless. I mean, if you step back and look at it, there's no way that would provide fulfillment and satisfaction. Just think of the places that people look. I mean, drug addiction. I mean, is that going to bring happiness? Does that make much sense? Wealth. Is that really going to bring fulfillment and satisfaction? I mean, and you could go on and on. We look in all the wrong places. So part of what God is doing is clearing our vision as to what is really in our interests and helping us to understand that living life the way we were meant to live it ultimately is the only way that fulfillment can be gained. So part of it is just clearing that vision and then helping us to live our lives in conformity with his values.
And coming, which doesn't preclude effort.
Not at all.
It's just the application of that effort towards what is genuinely good and true and valuable in life.
Right.
Okay, that's
right.
Helpful.
Right. Any other questions? Margaret?
This is a speculation, but I mean, asking for a speculation, but how do you suppose Abraham knew when this being encountered him that he was the God of the universe? It's kind of interesting that it seems to me it's another flip-flop of the Adam and Eve story, where Adam and Eve had a chance to observe God all along doing all this stuff, and they knew, had from direct experience, that he was the source of everything that they had, and yet they didn't trust him. And here, Abraham, who's been worshiping the moon goddess and whatever the heck they worshipped in those things, God comes along, and he apparently hasn't been aware of him up to this point, or he presumably would have been worshiping him, and he says, "Hi, I'm the God of the universe," and he says, "Oh, great." Apparently. I was just wondering.
My suspicion is that it didn't quite work that way. I read a paragraph last week out of Noel Samuel Kramer's book on the Sumerians about Sumerian religion, and he points out, and I don't know for sure whether this is relevant to Abram or not, but in the Sumerian world, there were over 4,000 gods. And those gods were very specialized gods. And there are so many gods doing so many different things that people did not feel a personal connection to any one of them. And there evolved this other concept of personal gods, that there would be these little godlets that would kind of take someone on as their own project and kind of take care of them as best they could.
Like the household gods of the Romans?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So my suspicion is that God comes to Abram, and Abram's first inclination is to think, oh, a godlet has seen fit to be good to me. Now, he's making pretty big claims for what he's going to do with me, and I'm sure that must have been a little bit of a tension in Abram's mind. But I suspect that Abram doesn't initially think, oh, this is the God of the universe that's talking to me. It takes time for Abram to come to realize that that's indeed who he is dealing with. Over time, he begins to see how this God, the power of this God, becomes more and more remarkable, more and more far-reaching in a way that I don't think he really, Abram, envisioned at the beginning. Now, I'm just guessing, but that's my guess as to how it evolved. It just seems hard for me to believe that someone coming out of a polytheistic culture immediately says, ah, the God of the universe has just spoken to me. I mean, it's possible, but I'm inclined to think rather that it would have been an evolution.
And why would he have trusted that God? I mean, I think from my perspective, if I weren't a Christian now, when I wasn't a Christian, if God had shown up and said, or something had shown up and made me grand promises and said, if you'll only obey me, mm-hmm. I would have said, why? Why should I trust you? And I think I'd probably say that now, too, if I couldn't establish the identity of the person making the claim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a good answer to that, because there's a sense in which it seems to me that's the experience of all of us. That as God begins to work in our life, there's still the question, why do I trust you? Now, it's true that we have this concept that he is the God of the universe, but I don't know that there's a good answer to why Abram responded immediately to God. We will see, it seems to me, in the account that Abram shows signs of indications of faithlessness as the account proceeds. He grows in faith. We don't have complete faithfulness right from the beginning. And I don't know. God is very mysterious in the way that he works in our lives, but he granted Abram the faith that was necessary to begin this process.
I was thinking, though, if it happened to me, I have a concept of devils, too, who might make grand promises and deceive me. Mm-hmm. Maybe Abraham didn't have that concept. It didn't occur to him that this might be a malevolent being. So that would be my concern, mm-hmm. is, you know, if it really is the God of the universe, I intend to believe him, but is this really the God of the universe?
Right, right. Don't know.
When I came to faith, there was not a lot of content to it, but it was more of a dawning of light. I mean, it really is hard to put into words, but all through the Bible, the analogy of light and darkness, God turning the people that he chooses toward the light. Right. And there's something in us that responds and said, yes, this is true, and this is what I want. I think both of those are a... I guess dealing with the beings that he created, turning them around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Andrew?
You mentioned the word fulfillment a few times, and it kind of caught my attention.
Uh-huh.
I assume that it's based on he's coming to Abram and saying, I'm going to give you this. You need this. I'm going to give you this. Or mm-hmm. he's giving him all these things that he needs, perhaps. It would be easy for us or for me to read into that he's going to give me everything I need to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could compare that with, say, Solomon's reflections on life's futility mm-hmm. in terms of fulfillment. What is fulfillment if there is fulfillment in this life? And how is that reconciled with Solomon's perspective of futility? And also the verse where of Jesus talking about, I've come to give you life, more abundant life, which mm-hmm. I think is often taken to mean that I'm going to fulfill all your needs. Mm-hmm. And that's apparently not what God's all that interested in doing. So is that, I don't know if that's clear enough, but those are just some things that came to mind when you talked about fulfillment.
Yeah. I think what God says is, I'm going to bless you. And by blessing him, I think that's where he's saying that, as opposed to what happened in response to the rebelliousness of man, that is, making everything fail, I am going to bring success, fulfillment, and satisfaction. That's ultimately what God is going to do in Abram's life, and that's ultimately what he's going to do in the lives of all of us. He's not what becomes clear as we live our lives out is that that's not going to be fulfilled in this life. This life is going to be a combination of a taste of the fulfillment to come, mixed in with a lot of the futility that we experienced and pain that we will continue to experience throughout our lives. That those things still play a really important role in our lives. Because as rebels, it's difficult for us to wean ourselves away from the ways of a rebel. And to be, I mean, we've all had the experience of having things go well for a short period of time that God I assume you've all had an experience. I've had it many times, where it will appear as though God is making things work in my life. And I'll go for a period of time when things seem to be all falling into place in a way that is truly remarkable. If that happens very long, my assumption is I have figured out how to live life now. I can do this. I can keep this string going. And the futility that's in life comes to play again, a reminder that it's not me that makes those things happen, that makes things fall into place, that makes that brings about the fulfillment and satisfaction that only God can bring. So our life is going to be a combination of continuing to experience that frustration and pain, but as believers, glimpses of the fulfillment and satisfaction that we will ultimately experience completely. But now we just get a taste of.
Excuse me. I think that Abraham points to the fact that we can learn much about his life and then how it shows us that. I believe that one of the reasons why God chose Abraham, that he was willing to say to God, okay, I'm going to do what you say you want me to do. And then also we can look in his life and see the examples of where either from fear, like for instance, in Egypt, and then when he said, okay, God, you've promised me this son, but I don't see it, and he took the maidservant and Ishmael. And we can see in that also that when he did that, the consequences of his decision, I believe, parallel what happened to those who did not accept God. And that we also see in our own lives those type of decisions that we make that, quote, when things seem to all of a sudden go well, that is directly related to our willingness to follow God and what he may have for us at this time. And so I think from my own personal view that Abraham, the biggest lesson we can learn from this is like, well, God wants to bless us, but how we are blessed and how much God blesses us is directly in proportion to how willing we are to follow him at that time. And when we don't, we suffer the consequences, the frustration, and the type of setbacks that you see in the people who don't follow God at all.
Yeah, there's a sense in which I think that that's right. It is very important to notice, however, that these promises that he makes to Abram are not conditional. He simply posits these promises. These are going to come to pass. So the picture that we get is God working in Abram to create the willingness that then leads him in the directions that bring these things to pass. God is determined right from the beginning. These things will happen. And, in fact, he brings those to pass. Any other questions, comments? One question in formation.
You may have already covered this, but when Abraham went out and met Melchizedek, or when Melchizedek came and met Abraham, Abram, it seems to me that Melchizedek probably had the right view of God.
I think that's probably right.
So we know at least by that point, Abraham had it, at least was told the whole story.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's true. Jack?
I'm not sure that's altogether true, though. Roger pointed out to me a few years ago, I guess, in Exodus chapter 6, this is God, Yahweh, talking to Moses. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for under compulsion he will let them go, and under compulsion he will drive them out of his land." God spoke further to Moses and said to him, "I am Yahweh, and I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, God Almighty, God the Most High. But by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them," and so on. Now, if we look at it as just, I used to go by Sam, and now I go by Fred, that's not a particularly significant claim. But it seems to me that that's not what he means by that. That as El Shaddai, now you can speak to this, but I know the Babylonians in the Gilgamesh epic, I think it describes Marduk as the hoop that holds the barrel together, that he's the God Most High. You have these thousands of gods, but there is a God who brings a sort of order to the universe because he's able to kind of keep all the other gods as forces under control. And I'm wondering if Abraham only reached the level of believing that this God who had appeared to him was the God Most High, just like Marduk was to the Babylonians, that Abraham believed that this God who appeared to him was the God Most High. And that what's really significant at when God reveals himself to Moses at Mount Sinai is now he's actually even more than the God Most High. He is He who is, Yahweh. And that's the first time God has actually revealed himself as the God in the sense that we know him and the God in the sense that we believe that he is.
Remind me, in Hebrews, what does it say with respect to Abraham, what it was that he believed?
I don't think it addresses his view of God, not his view of God that I can remember.
What does it say? Let's look at that.
By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead, as that as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. All these died in faith, without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own, and indeed if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And then Isaac.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Oh, one more.
I thought it was kind of interesting. I ran in Psalm 15. I can find this real quick. Sometimes I wonder about what the early fathers, how they conceived of what was going to happen to them, and how much the question has come up, how much of this blessing they conceived of as being relevant down here, and how much later. And wait, is it Psalm 15? Psalm 17, I'm sorry. And at the end, in Psalm 17, David, I guess it's a Psalm of David, Yes. He's talking about his many enemies trying to bring him down, and he says, Arise, O Lord, confront him, bring him low. Deliver my soul from the wicked with your sword, from men with your hand, O Lord, from men of the world whose portion is in this life and whose belly you fill with your treasure. They are satisfied with children and leave their abundance to their babes. As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. I will be satisfied with your likeness when I awake. I've been thinking about what he means by satisfied with your likeness, and I'm wondering if there's a strange inversion or a inversion in what he says, that the men of the world are satisfied with blessings down here. They truly are. When God gives them children and abundance to will to those children, they truly are happy with that. Mm-hmm. And certainly David had plenty of wealth and children, but he wasn't satisfied with it. And the inversion, I think, I'm wondering, this likeness, I haven't looked at the Hebrew yet, but I'm wondering if what he's actually literally referring to is the fact that originally we were created in God's likeness and it got destroyed to the extent that you could almost say we were no longer in his likeness. And what's going to happen in heaven is we will now, David expects to have that likeness again. And the inversion is the men of the world are satisfied with bequeathing their abundance to their offspring. David is going to be satisfied with God's abundance being bequeathed to him, God's offspring, his likeness. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, David certainly understood that. Mm-hmm. Maybe Abraham did too.
Mm-hmm. 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 That's good. Okay, thanks.